This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
Hi, team. You're listening to WRFL Lexington. It's right about 6 o'clock, which means you're listening to The Gay Show. I'm your host, Kay, and for the next hour, we'll chat about gay stuff, as one does on The Gay Show. We'll talk about culture, politics, education, music, psychology, science, whatever. This time, music, which will be fun because I haven't done it in a hot minute. So this week, we're going to be talking about the pansexual Afrofuturist queen that we need but don't deserve, Janelle Monáe, and her 2018 album Dirty Computer, just named NPR's for number one album of the year. The second album was Mitski's Be the Cowboy, which I am also obsessed with and would highly recommend, but is not the topic of this show currently. But as per usual, I want to jump back and talk about our previous week, when I discussed the idea of who is and isn't grievable, and who is and isn't deserving of respect, and what it means to make those decisions and express one's behaviors in a public space, or rather when someone else can engage with you, and how we accommodate all of those feelings when some people have been deeply harmed by someone, and when some people still love them. So last week's discussion started with the death of George H.W. Bush, who was president from 1989 to 1993, who was president at a time in which the American government's administration existed at a time in which almost 120,000 people died of AIDS-related causes. He was also responsible, singularly, more or less, for appointing Justice Clarence Thomas, who has consistently opposed pro-LGBTQ+ legislation. For example, the bill that allowed us to have same-sex marriage. It's clear that Bush's impact is wide-reaching, and his legacy will impact us for decades to come. Whether you believe that to be good or bad is really up to you. I talked about the idea of how when Justice Scalia died, sort of unexpectedly, from, if I remember correctly, it was a heart attack, many LGBTQ+ people were really disrespectful towards his passing, and that many people who were not doing that sort of believed that these statements were inappropriate, based on the idea of we shouldn't speak ill of the dead. So the question then became, how then do we accommodate these experiences and feelings for everyone? I talked about how if someone who is LGBTQ+ identified, and I have been, so for this person, not me, if they have been deeply and personally impacted by the AIDS crisis, for example, literally having friends die during that time period, then mourning the loss of George H.W. Bush is probably not something they're really interested in at all. I probably still, again, this person, they probably still have anger and grief and experience loss over the friends that they probably had watched possibly die, people that would likely have been alive today. Particularly because if HIV/AIDS research was better funded or even allowed to be funded or researched during that time period, we would probably be much further along than we are today. When in reality, one of the people who is responsible for helping to not only spread the awareness of, but also synthesize what we now refer to as AZT, it's one of the major sort of drugs in the HIV/AIDS treatment cocktails. Essentially, you give multiple different drugs all at the same time to allow someone who has AIDS or HIV to sort of live a normal and healthy life. So that person was Canadian and not American, specifically Jewish Canadian, or was Jewish and also Canadian, which is really wonderful and really amazing. What matters is that the American government was doing nothing. So how then can that person, who may or may not have literally watched friends die during this time period, be expected to mourn the loss of this man? And how, then, can they be expected to be respectful? What does it mean for them, an individual who has personally been impacted by legislation that existed under the Bush administration, to likely have watched friends die and see other people mourn him? To summarize this in a better sort of way, and I'll use like myself as an example to make it easier to walk through. So let's say I deeply hate someone. I'm not angry in the sense of we got into an argument and I'm still bitter about it. I'm angry in the sense that I feel like I've been deeply harmed by this individual and my life has been changed because of it. How then can I accommodate other people who really like that person? I don't think I should be expected to accommodate those other people's feelings, or really the person who harmed me's feelings. I don't actually care about their feelings, to be quite honest. I hate this person. In some scenarios in which I'm forced to continue interacting with these other friends, or even the person who is harmful in particular, I might be forced to be civil. Or rather, I would likely only be civil because it's the only option I have. But sometimes, and especially if you have the power to do so, you need to cut people out of your life to protect yourself. And that's okay. And regardless of whether or not that person who deeply harmed you got better, grew, no longer makes those mistakes, you have no responsibility to allow them back into your space. Even if they have fixed themselves is sort of an odd word, but even if they have sort of restored themselves and gotten better and no longer makes that mistake, you have no obligation to forgive them or even allow them into your space at all. Sometimes bridges that are burned are not repaired. And it also means, though, that the people you grieve over and mourn over is also a choice. We can't control our feelings. To repress them isn't really great. It's not good because it'll just hurt you as a person, right? The internalization of emotions is bad. But the ways in which we express those emotions in a public space or in front of others is something we have control over. And those behaviors, like all of our behaviors, have ramifications for how others see us and how we see ourselves. I think to expect anyone to be civil in the wake of a loved one or an important person's death is sort of an odd rule. And the level of disrespect that's geared towards an individual is obviously going to vary based on the person's impact in the world, like George H.W. Bush. But I'm guessing no one is going to suggest just crashing his funeral and ruining it, but they will take to a social media platform and criticize his legacy that will inevitably be turned into something positive, right? When we eulogize people, we make them exclusively seem positive and ignore all of the problems that they had. And I think the ability to criticize someone like that is appropriate and fair, or maybe not necessarily so much to say that this is their decision to do so, but like those who are expressing their grief in a public space, they're choosing to do so in many ways. Those behaviors also have ramifications. I don't really want to get into the like legality or professional pieces of the use of social media, because I know it gets very murky very quickly there, and that I think is sort of a totally different conversation, right? The idea of whether or not we are allowed to use social media in our job decision hirings, what have you, etc. And I mentioned essentially that I summarized talking about how we expect people to be respectful. I used the example about the Department of Health and Human Services memo that effectively erases transgender individuals from documented sources. That's not really disrespect. That's deep government-level erasure. The expectation that a transgender person should be respectful with dealing of someone related or associated with this memo is kind of ridiculous. And yet we still see that. The idea that a minority person needs to be calm and collected to be believable. And that is awful and garbage. And if you are being attacked, and if you feel as if your entire identity is being literally erased from documents and from existence, you probably would also be pissed too. So if someone told you to calm down in that moment, you probably wouldn't, and you would probably get more upset. Just because there simply isn't any sort of... I mean, if there was a solution, which would be to stop doing that, to rescind that memo, that would be great, and that would probably fix the problem. But the fact that it even occurred at all is what is getting people upset, especially if that legislation passes. So, that was basically all of last week, summarized in 10 minutes or so. When we get back, we'll talk about Janelle Monáe, the love of my life, whose recent album, Dirty Computer, is perfect and brilliant and amazing, and everyone should listen to it. Well, here we are again, talking about Janelle Monáe. This is The Gay Show. I am your host, Kay. Just a moment ago, I talked about last week's show, which was the idea of who is and isn't deserving of respect, and how we express our behaviors in the wake of some sort of loss, whether that be the death of an individual or really any sort of grief. So I wanted to jump into Janelle Monáe's Dirty Computer because she is perfect. I very truly, honestly believe it's an album of our generation. And while her most recent album, Dirty Computer, is going to be the topic of conversation, and it has a million different elements to it, including sexuality, today I really wanted to focus on the elements of it surrounding race and racial ethnic identity, because it truly is an Afrofuturism masterpiece, or at least I think so, and I'm absolutely in love with it. She's often credited with this idea of like sort of neo-Afrofuturism, sort of a revival in the context of music. She clearly did not revive it in the sense that it's been going on for a very long time, or rather, it's about two decades old or so is the sort of lifespan of Afrofuturism. But her consistent use of Afrofuturism as a motif and theme and the ways in which she sort of wraps this idea together is particularly important. And her intersection of race and sexuality in Dirty Computer is frankly groundbreaking. And in just a hot second, we will talk about how much I love her. Okay, so Janelle Monáe, the love of my life, Dirty Computer, and frankly, most of her albums, particularly, I think it's Metropolis. She has a character called Cindy Mayweather, who is a huge deal and essentially incites an entire rebellion to take over society. Janelle Monáe has very successfully and very importantly weaved Afrofuturism as a motif or as an art style in a form of political commentary into effectively everything she's done. The album right before Dirty Computer, Electric Lady, also takes the motif of a sort of sorority. If you're unaware, sort of historically black sororities and fraternities have a slightly different take compared to most other social fraternities and sororities, and are often incorporated and have a very specific vibe to them, with additional focuses on culture and professionalism and all of these other things. So to essentially take that and layer it into an Afrofuturistic context is really important. So, since I have said Afrofuturism 12 times now, and I'm going to be talking about Dirty Computer, which is solely based on Afrofuturism, I should probably explain what that concept is and understand why it's so important and why it's a narrative that is underrepresented and brilliant. And to understand Afrofuturism, then, one must generally understand the concept of, or at least have a definition of, diaspora. Diaspora, then, is, broadly speaking, the movement of a people or culture into a new space. And when you have an entire group of people moving into a new space, you have a massive, fast sort of interblending and creation of art and politics and education and just culture interweaving, producing something entirely new. Right, that's sort of how culture works. Oftentimes, the word diaspora was originally created, arguably, in the context of Jewish people moving out of Israel, but is often applied to many other cultures and contexts. The African-American diaspora culture then, in conjunction, or rather exists, not necessarily in terms of movement of people with Jewish faith, rather the African-American culture and diaspora is actually at the intersection of technology. And that's what makes up Afrofuturism in this case, right? So it's African-American diaspora, it's the movement of people creating this new blend of cultures at the intersection or interwoven with technology, right? That's literally the futuristic aspect of it. So Afrofuturism then takes these ideas of combining sci-fi, fantasy, magical realism, and Afrocentrism. So that's the idea of centering everything around blackness. Instead of having, you know, diverse characters, the diverse character by definition there, the minority character in Afrocentric pieces, is the white person. And taking all of these concepts and combining them with these sort of like non-Western beliefs of magics and cultures and nature and all of these other things interwoven that we often ignore in Western media or Western literature. And almost always Afrofuturism is used as a way of criticizing and creating political messages about the current lived experiences of Black people, or understanding a way in which to revise and acknowledge the past lived experiences of Black people. Afrofuturism, then, is the creation of a totally new world many times. Famous artists and writers and characters such as Octavia Butler, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Erykah Badu, and even Marvel's Black Panther are all examples of producers of, or the product of, Afrofuturism. I think Black Panther is a really great example, mostly because literally everyone knows who Black Panther is nowadays. If you haven't seen the movie, hopefully you still know who Black Panther is. He's a big deal, particularly having a movie that produced that much money that quickly on such a great budget with that much visibility. And it's essentially, right, so I talked about these past lived experiences or current lived experiences, and a lot of ways Black Panther creates a world in which what the world of African peoples could look like if the historical damage of imperialism and slavery hadn't happened. It's essentially the future of Wakanda exists in a world in which their technological advances and culture was not destroyed. It's essentially a brilliant beauty of technology and science and nature all wrapped up together, and it is sort of a classic example of Afrofuturism. The idea of robots or androids or cyborgs are also frequent examples of Afrofuturism, such as in Janelle Monáe's previous works and in this current work. And there is a great space in which she also often expresses her gender and sexuality, an identity that really came to the forefront in this album, because not only is her girlfriend actually in it, but she also came out as pansexual immediately prior, or I guess right before the release of the album. So sexuality and gender and race all sort of intertwine together in the context of this album, and I'm sort of going to try and pull apart the racial ethnic sort of aspects of it, because I think it's also particularly important to talk about. When most of the time, I think we often center it around the fact that she used cyborgs and androids and robots often as a metaphor or a stand-in for sexuality and gender, right? So it's like, oh, who are you attracted to? Well, I'm a robot, so that question doesn't matter. So in that way, we're often talking about Dirty Computer when she specifically came out as this idea of her coming out of the closet, when in reality, all of her work has been very Afrofuturistic and very queer identified from the get-go. So I want to sort of acknowledge and talk about the Afrofuturistic aspect of it in particular. So with all of that in mind then, I want to play for you the first self-titled track on Janelle Monáe's album. So it's called Dirty Computer, and following this, I'll move forward immediately afterward and talk about the following song, Crazy Classic Life. We'll return then and break those things down and why they're relevant and wonderful, because honestly, regardless of the message that Janelle Monáe produces, they're all bops, to be frank, and she's brilliant. For those of you who are interested in the music, the album is also a visual album that is beautiful that you can watch on her website for free. I'm not going to talk about that part today because I don't want to spoil anything, but I would highly recommend it. And it absolutely creates a new vivid imagery that people might not initially expect and is wonderful. So here's Dirty Computer and Crazy Classic Life by Janelle Monáe. Okay, so hopefully you think those tracks are as wonderful and amazing as I do. So let's talk about them. So Dirty Computer provides the context for the rest of the album, right? So I played the first two tracks that you would hear if you just played the album all the way through. So it provides that context. And for the visual album, it describes her body very literally and effectively as a dirty computer, because they're like androids in the album, which is not surprising for her. So this idea of being tainted or having a bug or a virus, in a lot of ways, sort of resembles the idea of internalized stigma, or really stigma more broadly, that I've sort of mentioned several times if you have listened to the show before. If you remember past shows, stigma is essentially this idea of self-deprecation and believing of negative stereotypes of one's own group, even if you know that they're not true, and is often some sort of physical or mental representation. So this idea of being inherently broken, poisoned, or in this case, dirty hardware, to me resembles this context, or this concept. And then immediately afterwards, we get flung into a new world, one in which MLK Jr., or a mirror of him, is living and provides a speech. In this context, it's actually Pastor Sean McMillan, and that's a sort of sample from one of his sermons where he is talking about and reflecting on that dream. So, Crazy Classic Life, right? So this world that we're flung into, one in which Janelle Monáe's blackness is front and center, and it's really not a new world, it's our current one. And honestly, at least how I interpret this work, Janelle Monáe's Dirty Computer actually embraces the idea of patriotism, which is sort of the exact opposite of what one might think when listening to an album like this or thinking about Afrofuturism, right? The criticism of an America with slavery and institutional racism often results in anti-American sentiments because there are plenty of obvious reasons to believe that. But in this case, I actually think Dirty Computer is patriotic, and we'll talk about that more and more. So she uses Afrofuturism to produce a world in which blackness is celebrated everywhere, in which the truest of Americas, one in which diversity is always celebrated and identities are safe, is created. This sort of gets driven home over and over and over again when she says, "I'm not America's nightmare, I'm the American cool." The crazy classic life she's talking about isn't something that's new to the American dream. It's very literally the sort of wild ride and explosively fun experiences of what it means to be in your late 20s, or in your late teens and 20s, right? It's this idea of being out late and partying and doing whatever you want. And the example here is about how many times black people can't, or rather don't, have that opportunity because of institutional racism that has spread throughout our country. The ending portion of this song explains it a lot, in which she very explicitly talks about when interacting with police officers, she's perceived differently from her white friends, how they end up being forced onto different paths, in which Janelle Monáe's character is prevented from going to college, and their paths diverge entirely, right? So one of them goes off to college, her white friend, presumably, and she's forced into a domestic labor job. Not to suggest that domestic labor is bad by any means, but the forcing of a profession or career is obviously bad. And these motifs pop up over and over and over again. And Monáe, the genius she is, frequently blends together her own experiences with blackness and her sexuality. And as I mentioned before, she has typically used androids or cyborgs or robots as stand-ins for these sorts of identities in particular, and it appears again and again in this album as well. It's not even appearance, the entire album is about androids. She actually has an album called Arc Android. And what I love about Crazy Classic Life even more is her line, "I just want to find a God, and I hope she loves me too," which actually, depending on who you ask or what album you're listening to, is either "I just want to find a guy" or "God." And it's interesting because that those two specific lines can be interpreted regardless of how you hear it. And I'm guessing it's very intentional, right? So it's this idea of being intentionally ambiguous. Either way, she bends gender and those assumptions, right? So we often perceive God as an omniscient, all-knowing creator who is almost certainly male, even if we don't always like sort of explicitly acknowledge that. So having like a sort of female God in this case is really important and a very specific reference, particularly when we think about LGBTQ plus identities. And this specific motif appears again for LGBTQ plus identities, right? So if I say, "I want to find a guy and I hope she loves me too," you're literally presenting a dichotomy of men and women, a singular two-line track. She herself acknowledges that, like, gender's not real for her, which is simplifying it in the sense that, like, she can be attracted, she's potentially attracted to all individuals, or all genders, right? Which is what I've described pansexuality as before. So it's not gender blindness, right? So it's not gender isn't real. It's the idea that she has the potential to be attracted to anyone of any gender. So the idea of bending those rules and acknowledging that could be either a man or a woman in the sort of broadest sense is particularly important here. And I think that's really, really wonderful. And you see that coming back again and again and again as we sort of move through the entire album. And essentially here, I want to now play this specific track that more sort of goes in. It's like, it's rap instead of sort of a big orchestral track. So here is Django Jane, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do as well. Okay, so that was Django Jane, which is also wonderful and brilliant, and I hope you like it. That is more or less in the middle of the album, right? These sort of recurring themes over and over and over again, as I will continue to mention forever, because I think she is brilliant and amazing. But right, she has this line, they kept them in the back of the store, essentially, and now they're full front and center. And the idea of blackness being a camo, with the idea being that blackness is erased in our literature and media, and Afrofuturism as a vehicle for political commentary or criticism of the lived black experience is the exact opposite of that, right? So much of our media that we consume is white, or everyone who is in it racial ethnically is Caucasian in some form. So to have a world in which everyone is black is sort of startling to a typical viewer, right? So if you've seen Black Panther, that's exactly what happens, right? There's only one sort of prominent character who is white in the entire movie, and that's the secret agent person. But this idea of essentially being, for the longest time, the African-American people have sort of been pushed back and back and back and have been domestic laborers by, you know, forced choice, and this idea of being on these diverging paths from this other girl that is a continuing character in the visual album, right, from Crazy Classic Life. In this moment, she's now talking about how they've been in the back of the store the whole time, and now they're front and center, and people have to deal with them. And Janelle Monáe as a person actually does a lot of that work herself. She is, I believe it's called, she's the founding member of the Black Wonderland Arts Collective, which is this idea of having a ton of different African-American artists producing music and literature and really basically any kind of art in that vein. And the idea of producing more and more art that is a function of political commentary on the lived Black experience in America. And they also had like a very big part and role. They even wrote a song as part of the Black Lives Matter movement, and they're prominent figures in the women's, the current women's movement, like Me Too and the Women's March, all of these different things going on, with the idea being that, yes, Afrofuturism uses Afrocentrism, right? Everything is centered around blackness as an experience, but African-American identities or racial ethnic identities don't exist in a vacuum, right? The lived experience of an African-American woman is different from an African-American man, is different from an African-American woman who is a lesbian, et cetera, et cetera. So to have all of these different political experiences and commentary and art, like Dirty Computer, is to acknowledge all of these different intersections of identities. And in just a moment, we'll wrap up and talk a little bit more about how Dirty Computer, even though it is deeply political and highly critical of racial ethnic sort of relations today in America, is, I would argue, patriotic in nature, which is sort of fun and exciting. So, we've now talked about Dirty Computer, the title track, Crazy Classic Life, which, in conjunction with Dirty Computer, are the first two songs on the album, providing you context of this idea of we're continuously taught to pull this part of our identity out of us, right? So in this context, for Dirty Computer, it's unclear, but it's probably both, the fact that one's blackness or one's racial ethnic identity, that identity saliency or achievement in conjunction with an LGBTQ plus identity is the thing that is tainting them and making them different and standing out from a crowd when in reality they're not supposed to. And that sets the context for the entire album, right? Where Crazy Classic Life talks about how she wants to have this experience that everyone else experiences while maintaining her really important identities that are relevant to her and sort of shape her lived experiences and give her this view of the world. With the idea being asking for both shouldn't actually be that much of a request, right? The idea of, wow, I would like to be both African-American and pansexual in this world without police officers treating me differently, really shouldn't be that big of a request. And now we have an album about it. So that's the sort of functioning you have going on. And then we have Django Jane, which this is, she sort of moves forward again, the idea of, okay, we wanted these things. We live in this world in which these identities are not welcome, are not celebrated, and are considered dirty or poison or negative. And we hit halfway through the album, and she talks about how currently in their life, they've moved, they're pushed to the back. No one wants to see them. No one wants to be seen by them. Almost certainly because of their blackness. And in that moment, sort of, you see this big shift of an uprising, right? This idea of, for so long, her African-American identity or her blackness has been invisibilized, right? They've been erased from literature and media and basically all forms of art in our current world. And in this context, pushed down to be nothing for so long that they're now coming forward and sort of fighting for this new context. So now that I've hopefully given you enough background and backstory to this whole album, and for those of you who are going to see or have seen the visual album of Dirty Computer, we'll actually end with the track Americans. And this is where I get the idea that the album is deeply patriotic, right? She literally calls a song Americans. And if you watch the visual album, it's layered over her winning. And it's a moment in which she sort of survives and lives and becomes what I would argue a patriot, which I personally think is beautiful. I think she really pulls together the idea that blackness is integral to and has always been a part of America and the American experience. And while it should be celebrated, the reality of that is different. She pulls in the pastor, Sean McMillan, again, to sort of extend MLK Jr.'s dream into something new, into our current world, talking about a future with a country without borders, but still deeply patriotic, right? It's, I love this country, and other people can come in because we have all of this love. A world in which African-American people are not assaulted, a world in which LGBTQ plus individuals are able to love who they want to love. And she pulls all of these things together with the idea of saying this sort of progressivism, this sort of acceptance, this sort of love, this sort of rebellion, arguably, is part of what it means to be an American, right? So we always talk about our American ideals being a melting pot, diversity, individualistic, and the idea of creating a space and a community and a society in which all of this diversity, all of these different lived experiences are not only allowed to exist, but they're able to come and celebrate and, you know, sort of be proud of those experiences altogether. And that's sort of the last track of the album. And at least for me, I think it's really important, right? So it's this idea of patriotism as a form of criticism within itself, right? So Afrofuturism, as I've mentioned before, is often surrounding this idea of racial ethnic identity being sort of front and center, right? So Afrofuturism and commentating or creating some sort of political criticism around the current lived experiences of Black people in the United States because they are clearly experiencing maltreatment, or re-envisioning or taking a new lens or perspective from past experiences, similar to Black Panther, which sort of simultaneously does both. And in this way, it's sort of the idea of I can simultaneously love my own country and also be highly critical of it, with, at least to me, the idea being, I love this place so much, and I want to make it better, and I want to make it better for everyone, and that is what makes me an American. And you'll notice in just a few moments, she'll sort of pull in all of these other ideas. She'll pull in, like, sort of classic Americana motifs, which is sort of quirky and, at least to me, weird, and very much so to me weird, because it's sort of foreign to me as a first generation American. But you'll feel all of those things, and you'll you'll listen to all of those things when she plays, when I play the track Americans, and about how her survival and the survival of a country that is brilliant and beautiful and progressive is almost exclusively dependent on the survival of people who have identities that are celebrated. And it's not subtle. She goes right for it, and I think it's beautiful and amazing. So without further ado, here is Americans by Janelle Monáe. It also starts out with a really beautiful, like, sort of church choir vibe, which is often sort of understood in the context of African-American religious context, right? That big, big choral space, which unsurprisingly, like every single other piece of the album, is very clearly intentional. So without further ado, here is Americans by Janelle Monáe. So that was Janelle Monáe's Americans. It was brilliant and beautiful and amazing, and I think it's brilliant and beautiful and amazing. And if you've noticed, she literally says, Uncle Sam kissed a man, Jim Crow Jesus rose again, with this idea being, right, like, to build this America, you have to make things gay and sort of push back against institutional racism and all of those things. And with that, I'm done. That's all I have for you today. This is The Gay Show. I'm your host, Kay. The background music you've been listening to is Emily Sprague's Water Memory. Earlier this year, she came out with an album called Mount Vision. If you really liked this fun ambient electronica, definitely go check her out. She's really fun. And stay tuned for more fun jams coming up next.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.fm, and of course via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to WRFL.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.